Chapman tells of a visit to a country town in New South Wales where he was the speaker at some evangelistic meetings arranged by the local church. While he was visiting door to door, he came upon an elderly man, a very elderly man, sitting on his front porch, and John went up and invited him to the meetings. The man declined because of his considerable old age and his considerable ill health, and as they engaged in conversation, John said to him as part of the conversation, "You've mentioned how old you are, and you've mentioned your ill health. Does the prospect of dying worry you?" The old fellow laughed. He laughed. He said, "Do you think I'll go to hell, sonny?" To which John answered, "I think you have a distinct possibility of doing that." And the old fellow laughed again and gave the classic Australian answer to the whole question of hell. "Well, at least there'll be a lot of my mates there with me." See, for this man, eternity without God is viewed as no more than a big party with all the religious people taken out, which can only make the party better, can't it? But what confronts us in Revelation 17 and 18 jolts us out of the fantasy world into the world of sober reality. The God of justice will bring the whole created order to account. And in Revelation 15 through 20, we see God moving systematically through everything in creation, dealing with it. Now last week, for those who were in the congregation, in chapters 15 and 16 of Revelation, we saw the final judgment on rebellious humanity and the destruction of the universe painted large on a canvas. But before the new heavens and the new earth appear, which we read of just a moment ago in Revelation 21 and 22, the source of evil must be dealt with. And this begins in chapters 17 and 18 in detail and will continue next week in chapters 19 and 20. By the way, if you want to surprise your neighbours, tell them that the sermon today dealt with prostitution, adultery, drunkenness, nakedness and cannibalism, and that'll certainly get them thinking about what goes on in St James Tarramurra, won't it? But before we look at this vivid passage, let me remind you of the message that it contains using other words written by the same man, John, in his first letter. Chapter 2 and verses 15 through 17, because this sums up exactly what Revelation 17 and 18 is saying. "Do not love the world or anything in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For everything in the world, the cravings of sinful man, the lust of his eyes and the boasting of what he has and does, comes not from the Father, but from the world. The world and its desires pass away. But the man who does the will of God lives forever." You'll find the outline of where we're going inside the bulletin sheet today. Let me start by talking about the fact of Babylon from chapter 17 of the Revelation. If you've got your Bibles there, of course, flick them open to Revelation 17 and 18. The opening scene appears bizarre, but so does everything in Revelation. A great prostitute, decked out in the most gaudy but fabulously wealthy manner. She rides a scarlet beast with blasphemous names all over it and is seated upon many waters. Her name, we know from verse 5 of chapter 17, is Babylon the Great. It's no mystery. Mysteries in the Bible are not things you can never work out. They're things that God has made known. They once were mysterious, but he's revealed what they were to you. Great spiritual truths. Her name is Babylon the Great in verse 5. Immediately that name, of course, takes us back to the Old Testament, to the first mention of Babylon in the Bible. That's in Genesis chapter 11, under the name of Babel. Babel, Babylon, the same thing. You'll remember that incident where mankind builds this huge tower. It is mankind organizing itself in defiance of God, the beginning of a godless human system. Later, of course, Babylon, or Babel, grew to be a great civilization with a great city, wealthy and magnificent, the capital of a great empire that overthrew the little kingdom of Judah and destroyed Jerusalem and its temple and carried its people and the treasures from the temple back to the city of Babylon, That's all recorded in 2 Kings, chapters 24 and 25. But Babylon became, of course, in the Bible, the symbol of godless, arrogant civilization, humanity organized against God and holding him in contempt. So here in Revelation 17. Now in John's day, of course, Rome and its empire were like that. It was a dominating, godless world power, symbolized as a great prostitute. From chapters 13, we know that the beast has already, we've already seen, is worldly, godless power, using politics, sometimes putting on a religious front, certainly having great leaders. The Roman emperors, John would have had in mind. That's what the horns and the heads and the hills are all about, symbols of strength. Some had already passed away, others were still to come. This worldly power has its day. It seems to pass away, but it always rises again in some form. Now, in the first century AD, Rome epitomised that worldliness, humanity setting itself up as ruler in opposition to God. But in every age it appears in various forms, as old as Babel itself. This godless human worldliness is called a prostitute because of her alluring power. Her attractions are almost irresistible. That's why peoples and nations and multitudes are given her their allegiance and committed adultery with her. That's why John uses the sexual metaphor to emphasize an almost irresistible force at work and at work in us. See, this is what worldliness is. It sometimes manifests itself, regularly manifests itself, in great godless civilizations and great godless leaders throughout history, but it also manifests itself in individual human beings like you and me, making humanity unfaithful to God, opposed to God, making us spiritual adulterers. Second thing I want you to notice is the foe of Babylon, who is mentioned. Mention is made peppered throughout chapters 17 and 18. The deadly foe of Babylon, the one Babylon hates and seeks to destroy, is the one called the Lamb, that is Jesus, and any who choose to follow the Lamb, and thereby those ones do not get caught up with the prostitute and the beast. See, there's a fundamental clash of two ideologies between these two. In verse 14, it's a war. See what it says? They will make war against the Lamb, but the Lamb will overcome them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and with him will be his called, chosen and faithful followers. See, when any human being says, we want to live our lives our own way with our own value system, they are on a collision course with the one who is Lord of lords and King of kings. And I ask you the question again, who do you think is going to win when the collision takes place? Who do you think is going to win if you set yourself in opposition to the Lord of lords and the King of kings? Well, there's no question, is there? And let me say, there's a conscious decision that needs to be made in life, and it needs to be worked out moment by moment, each and every day. The question is, the decision is, who will have my allegiance? Who will have my allegiance? Will I give my allegiance to Babylon, worldliness, living my own life my way, or will I give my allegiance to Jesus the Lamb? But do know this, before you answer that question, if you cast your lot in with the Lamb, it's going to mean these three things. One, you'll have to face opposition as you live in this world. Look at verse 6. I saw the woman was drunk with the blood of the saints and the blood of those who bore testimony to Jesus. Satan, who inspires all godless worldliness, will actively oppose you. And for some Christians, it will mean physical death. Remember, that shouldn't surprise us. Remember Jesus' words in the Gospel in John chapter 15, the night before he died? He said to his followers, if the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. As it is, you do not belong to the world, but I've chosen you out of the world. That's why the world hates you. Remember the words I spoke to you. No servant is greater than his master. If they persecuted me, they'll persecute you also. If they obeyed my teaching, they will obey yours also. They will treat you this way because of my name. Secondly, you are called to live distinctively for Jesus. See the voice of God speaking in Revelation 18, verses 4 and 5. Then I heard a voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her. Come out of her, my people, so that you will not share in her sins, so that you will not receive any of her plagues. For her sins are piled up to heaven, and God has remembered her crimes." This does not mean, of course, coming out from Babylon doesn't mean having nothing to do with our godless society or with withdrawing from our society physically, but rather it means for Christian people living in our pagan society, interacting with unbelievers, but not living by their value system or their moral standard or by their thought patterns. Rather, we are to bring everything in our lives under the rule of Jesus. Every action, every thought, every attitude, every word is to come under the lordship of Jesus. It's what Jesus says in the Gospels in John 17 again when he prayed for his followers and he said, "My prayer is not that you take them out of the world, but that you protect them from the evil one. They are not of the world, even as I am not of it. Sanctify them by the truth. Your word is truth. As you sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world." But we must live distinctively in the world, not like the world. Thirdly, we will share the Lamb's victory. See in verse 14, the Lamb will overcome them because he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and with him, will be his called, chosen and faithful followers. We share the victory of Jesus. It's just like the Apostle Paul said in Romans chapter 8 when he said, "In all these things, in trouble and hardship, in persecution and famine and nakedness and danger and sword, in all these things we are more than conquerors through him who loved us." That is, through the Lamb. That's what will happen if you cast your lot in with the Lamb. But finally, on the other hand, what if you say no to the Lamb? "No, I'd rather follow Babylon." Note carefully what unfolds. In chapter 18, it is the fate of Babylon, not the face of Babylon, the fate of Babylon. In graphic detail, the downfall of the godless world orders and all worldliness, wherever it's found, is actually given. A mighty angel proclaims with sovereign authority, verse 2, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great." And in a moment, she's exposed for what she is. See in verses 3 and 4, she's totally depraved, totally satanic, totally opposed to God. Her proud boast in verse 7 of Revelation 18 is, "I sit as queen. I am not a widow. I will never mourn." Yet just like the historic kingdom of Babylon in Daniel 5, she falls in a moment. And three funeral laments go up for her from the kings of the earth, the merchants and the sea captains in verses 9 through 20. They weep, they mourn, not for love of her, but for having lost what they could get out of her. That's the nature of prostitution, by the way. You don't love the one, you want what she can give you. They are shocked at the speed with which her glory goes. Look at the end of verse 15. They will weep and mourn and cry out, "Woe, woe, O great city, dressed in fine linen, purple and scarlet, and glittering with gold and precious stones and pearls." In one hour, such great wealth has been brought to ruin. And in a final vivid picture, a mighty angel hurls a great stone the size of a millstone into the sea, symbolizing the destruction of Babylon. And after the initial turmoil and disruption, you know what it's like when you throw something into the sea, there's a great splash and all kinds of waves come up, but then the sea dies down and no one would ever have known that great grinding stone of worldliness had ever existed. No sign of existence remains, as smooth as glass as the surface of the sea. But notice, everything good, everything worthwhile, everything beautiful, everything lovely, every relationship of intimacy is taken from her. That's what verses 22 and 23 are about. Music and work, and produce and light, and relationship and celebration. They're all gone from her, and a dreadful silence covers all. The reason for that is very simple. See, all these things are the good gifts of God. So when God removes you from his presence, all good things go with God. Now, while this passage speaks of the end of all proud and godless worldliness of humanity, that translates into individuals' lives who follow the allegiance of Babylon and the world. Imagine, therefore, as I close, the scene a few moments after the death of a godless worldly man. I've read this to this congregation before, but it fits in so well today I can't resist reading it once again. The scene a few moments after the death of a godless worldly man. He'd never felt such aloneness before. "Where is my wife?" he choked. Only that awful echo. "Not here. Your wife is not here." He tried to piece it all together, but the darkness was too thick. Once in a while he thought he could see a blurred figure or hear an anguished moan. He remembered the pain, those last moments of terror, but it was nothing compared to the feelings that were creeping into his awareness now. Again he cried, "Where is my wife?" "Your wife is not here." "Where are my children?" "Your children are not here." He started to grope about in the darkness, but all was blindness. "My God," he howled again, "let me feel the presence of one single human being." "My God." He hadn't said those words in such a long time. "My God." And now they seemed so hollow. Terror was welling up in him. He felt like a small child being threatened by deep darkness. No candle anywhere, no love anywhere, no voice anywhere. "Where is my wife?" he screamed. "Your wife is not here." "Where are my children?" he pleaded. "Your children are not here." Then the greatest fear of all came to his mind. He was terrified to ask, but he knew he would have to. His whole body trembled as he pursed his lips and wailed into the nebulous night, "Where, oh, where is God?" As the deepest of all darkness closed in on his soul for all eternity, he heard that hideous echo whispering that most horrifying of all judgments: "God is not here." So whatever else you do today, heed the warning. Do not love the world or the things that are in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. For everything in the world, the cravings of sinful man, the lust of his eyes, the boasting of what he has and does, comes not from the Father, but from the world. The world and its desires pass away. But the man who does the will of God lives forever.